If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
And I've had a whole new appreciation for winemaking doing this because, and I think the quality of the wines that people are making from my grapes has improved the last couple of years just because I'm really doubling down, focused on quality. I mean, it has to be good. Certainly does for my label because, you know, an off year, I'm stuck with, 400 cases that I can't sell. So I have a renewed focus on quality.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 576. This week we feature Jack Florence of Florence Vineyard, Rock Pile ABA, Sonoma County. Our story today takes place in the Rock Pile AVA, found to the northwest of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County. Florence Vineyard sits above Lake Sonoma and is owned and farmed by Jack Florence. After growing grapes for many years, Jack now bottles wine under his own label from the 18-acre property. Zinfandel and Petite Sirah grow well here, and I caught up with Jack at the vineyard, which offers stunning views of Sonoma, as well as most excellent wine. You can also hear Jack on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term Brix.
Well, it's hard to believe we're outside in November, but we are. And I'm up at Florence Vineyard in the Rock Pile AVA of Sonoma. And I'm here with Jack Florence. Jack, how are you?
Fine. Thanks. Yourself, right?
I'm excellent. We have a beautiful day today. It's a warm with us in the sun, which we've got you in the sun. And blue skies. Not bad. And I say this a lot, but you guys just have an incredible view.
It's a beautiful spot to live and work.
Tell me about this space. What mountain are we on?
Well, this is this ridge is just the Rock Pile AVA. It's not any particular mountain. About 1,200 feet elevation.
Okay. And when you drive up here, you really get the feel for that because it's a typical winding mountain road. We'll go to the history of the vineyard here in just a minute, but how did you choose this particular site?
You know, it was just an ad in the paper that my mom cut out for me about 30 years ago.
Really?
There was some land for sale. Yeah, I was in the process of buying some land in Dry Creek Valley to start my first vineyard. And I came out here, there's like a little division of 10 lots, a little subdivision. And just kind of like with you, it just blew my mind. I couldn't believe it, how beautiful it was. And my feeling was, even if it didn't work for grapes, it'd be a wonderful place to live. But I could tell from just what I knew about soils and so forth that it had real potential for viticulture also.
What year did you purchase the land?
1992, just over 30 years ago.
That 92 doesn't sound like 30 years, though, does it?
It doesn't, you know. And, I bet you don't find many people that live in the same house for 30 years anymore. You know, although the first four, I had to live in a trailer to bolster my finances. Before, and actually planted the vineyard. I sacrificed myself to... I planted the vineyard before the house, so I was in the trailer for a few years.
Wow, good for you. Well, that's kind of called passion, I would guess,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No gains without pains, yeah.
That's right. Well, you are a junior. You're a Jack Jr., and your dad is in the business as well. So let's go back to your dad starting off in the business. Where did he start?
Yeah, he farmed in Dry Creek Valley since the mid-70s and had a Cabernet vineyard there in the middle of Dry Creek near Preston. Later, planted some Zinfandel and Petite Sirah at my urging, but once I moved out here, he and Mom would come out and visit, and they saw how beautiful it was, and there was another one of those 11 lots still for sale, and they bought one too, so they came out and became neighbors again.
So they're right up here somewhere.
About 8 years ago, they sold. They're very aged now, and they live in assisted living in Santa Rosa.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but on the other hand, I'm sure that was a full life being a farmer up in this kind of area because the challenges are different up here in the mountains.
It is, and Dad still loves the wine business and has a good relationship with the people who bought his property, who actually started their own label, and they're calling it We Know Jack, so it's kind of a homage to both him and I take care of it for him, so maybe it's both Jacks.
Yeah. That's really nice. That's very sweet they would do something like that, and it works because it's, you know, very contemporary.
Yeah, apparently, you know, Jack is all the rage these days. As well, yes. There's a Jack's Block. I'm glad to be named Jack right now. Yeah. I just say that.
I think Jack is a good name because, you know, your legal name is John, but we grew up with Jack Kennedy, and Jack has always been a nickname for John.
Yeah, a lot of people don't get that, you know, and I still get a lot of blank faces.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you got that, Ray. Yeah.
I've known more than one person in my life who had more than one name. What year did your dad start in the biz?
I would say 75.
So he goes back, again, quite a ways.
Yeah, he's 92 now. Yeah, he farmed for many years in Dry Creek Valley and about 10 years also up here at Rock Pile.
Wow, that's incredible. I have to say, I believe this is my first interview with a winemaker in the Rock Pile AVA. It's always been a little bit of a mystery to me. And when you come up here, you look and like, yeah, Rock Pile, I get it.
You know, it could be that Rock Pile started off with such a bang that... there was this assumption that you almost didn't need to talk to anybody. It was Rock Pile, you know, who needed sales or promotions or marketing? You know, Rock Pile was enough for all that. And, you know, I just started my own wine label a couple years ago, and I'm happy to get the word out and talk to people. And because it is a great AVA, especially in terms of varieties like Zinfandel and Petit Sirah.
Sure. And I'm a huge Petit Sirah lover. Like Zinfandel is too, but Petit Sirah is in my top three list. So
we're in agreement then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's a wonderful grape, and it's always so inky and just full-bodied and that sort of thing. It's really good. And I tried your Zin just before the interview, which was wonderful. It takes a while for me to find the kind of Zin that I like, but I really like that. It's just, I'm just one of those kind of people. But I think there are other people out there like that. Zin isn't for everybody.
Yeah, and Petit Sirah even for fewer.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was looking for kind of a niche variety like Zinfandel because I almost went with Merlot back in the, you know, mid-90s. That was all the rage. And I'm glad I did go with Zin because I was looking for a variety that would have more of a following, that a small producer could really, you know, have an impact. And Zin lovers are real, you know, the real fanatics. And so I think it's a good match for me, my style of farming and winemaking.
Yeah, I totally agree. Petit Sirah and Zinfandel, are these the only two varietals you're growing here?
That's it, yeah.
Right. Was there any particular reason you didn't want to go beyond that to Cabernet or something like that?
Yeah, you know, I could see, I started with Zin, and then I'd look for something to complement the Zinfandel, and Petit Sirah was a natural choice, and I didn't realize at the start that I would be making it by, you know, on its own, or that other winemakers would, but because the Zin here was just so rich and had great color on its own, the Petit was freed up to make its own varietal. I thought Cabernet would be more going off in a different direction, and I didn't want to, I'd like to be, you know, a small producer that's known for something rather than somebody who does a lot of reds and, you know, they really have no, you know, single, they're not really known for anything. So I think just having Petit and Zin, you kind of know what you're going to get when you have one of my wines. And like I said, I started out with the grapes I just started the wines a couple years ago. But even then, I also think those two varieties really make the most advantage of this kind of land, this kind of terroir.
Yeah, interesting with that. Now, I want to come back to your label in just a minute, but how many acres are you farming here?
There's 16 acres.
16 acres, and that's a lot. Is it you? Do you have a crew? Or, you know?
Oh, I have a crew, yeah. I mean, and labor, you know, has been tricky. And it gets worse every year. But over the years, I've had either, you know, long-term foremen and so forth, or people who've worked for me for several years. I still have a harvest crew that comes back every year. But right now, I'm kind of between, we'll be starting pruning again soon, and I'll be getting, I know a lot of workers in the industry now, but I don't have a fixed crew this year, but yeah, I don't do it all myself.
Yeah. No, I
do the tractor work.
Yeah. But I mean, even something like pruning, we were talking about that a few minutes ago.
A couple, two or three guys to help, yeah.
Yeah, because that would be really rough on you physically.
Yeah, although pruning, you know, you have 3 or 4 months to do it, but even so, it's good to have some help, yeah.
Well, I imagine like anything else too, you want to get it done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's typical. So let's talk about your label, obviously, Florence Vineyard, after your last name. And what nationality is Florence? I'm curious.
You know, dad is kind of a mix. My mom is Italian, but, you know, then Florence is on my dad's side. So I'd like to say it's Italian, but, it isn't.
Okay, well.
Some European a mix of some sort.
Sure. Well, being Sonoma, you could almost say it's Italian and nobody really argued with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good name for a wine label. People love the apparent connection with Florence, even though there is none in the city. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And we have part of the vineyard behind you. And it's interesting to look at it this time of year. Again, it's November. We've got this whole section here, which, of course, is getting ready to go to sleep, or already asleep, I guess, probably by now. And then we have, is this a replanting I'm looking on the other side?
Yeah, I'm doing a little bit of replanting. You know, I had one block that was really dropping off in production, and it turned out to be more just drought-related. So I had originally planned to replace a few more blocks, but I think it's going to be fine. And, I found that over the 30 years I've been growing here, the production is slowly declining as the vines get older. And that's kind of just, the nature of things. Farming costs go higher and income goes down. It's not the best scenario. And that's kind of one of the reasons I got into the wine part of it, is to kind of leverage that a little bit. And you can make more money on wine than you can on grapes, ideally, anyway. So.
Yeah, but it makes a lot of sense to have your own label and doing that. About how many cases are you producing?
400 cases a year.
Nice.
And I custom crush out near the winery, the same winery that buys my grapes, Masako Sonoma, which is part of the Wilson, group. Mm-hmm. They offered, if I was interested, to do some alongside their own, do some winemaking for me. And I thought, hey, what a great opportunity. And, I'm 60 this year, so if you're going to leave a legacy, it's about time to do it, in terms of...
You don't want to wait.
Yeah, in terms of having some wines. And also, there's the Wilsons, they do about 8 different vineyard designates for my vineyard, I've just worked with them since 2015. And having those wines out there, it's like it kind of opened my eyes to, once you see your name on a wine label, let's just put it that way.
Oh, yeah, sure. What year was your first vintage?
First vintage here was 96, and I sold to Rosenblum Cellars for the first 20 years, yeah.
Let me restate that question. What was Florence Vineyard as a label's first?
Florence Vineyard, the wine, was 2020.
Okay, so it's, And we were talking before about the fires, that you really didn't have any kind of smoke effect at all.
Right, there are people who dismiss the vintage out of hand, and they shouldn't, because it's a great vintage for the ones that were unaffected. And even though it got really smoky here, and I was telling you, Ray, we got evacuated, the smoke just... whether it was the timing or the amount of smoke, but it did not affect the grapes at all. And, a huge stroke of luck, especially for the first vintage, of my own wine, that it came through like that.
Well, you talk about dismissing a vintage out of hand. 2011 was a great example of that, because from what I hear, people will call it a winemaker's vintage because they've really made it, an excellent vintage.
Yeah, 2011 here was not that good.
No, okay.
So, but I'm sure, elsewhere, maybe a little bit better. It was a similar year to last year in terms of it was very cool, very mm-hmm. late harvest.
Sure.
Here, my Petite Sirah and the really late harvest, they'll run into rain sometimes.
Yeah, right.
So, but 2011, not one of the better ones, but this is kind of a microclimate rock pile, so.
Sure. Well, in the efforts to keep things totally honest, I'm going to keep that in. I'm not going to edit that out. I'm going to let myself look foolish. That's okay. But I have had some pretty amazing 2011s by some winemakers. Now, are you your own winemaker, or are they helping you with that?
Well, to answer the question that you asked, they help me out with it. I do have some input. I go out and taste blends. I make decisions on barrels and that kind of thing. I like to look at it as wine made in the vineyard kind of thing. In other words, I think by the time the grapes get to the winery, they're already 80-90% of the way there, and the rest of it's just kind of finishing up. And
sure.
So in that sense, in the vineyard, I have 100% of the decisions and control and so forth. But I try to let experts do what they know best, and whether it be the cellar crew or the winemaker I work with, they have great input and make great decisions because they make great wine themselves down there too.
A lot of winemakers say to me, don't screw it up.
Yeah, it's already, you just don't, yeah. It's You can't make a great wine out of mediocre grapes, but you can kind of screw up good grapes too. So
yeah, well said. Now, again, we were talking before the interview, as I drove up here on the side of the road, there was a rather dead wild pig and a rather large dead wild pig. And so you have to deal with wild pigs up here from time to time.
Yeah, you know, pigs and deer, pigs are one of those things that as long as you keep them out, you're fine. And the fence I have has some barbed wire in the bottom, which is meant to kind of keep the pigs out, because once they get in, they're really tough to get out. And
I understand they like to live in vineyards too.
They do. They like, especially this time of year when you have the first rains, the moist soil, or the summertime with some irrigation, they love to dig in that moist soil. So yeah, they're a real pain in the neck if they get in, and like deer, they're just best kept out, and then we can worry about other things.
Yeah, I imagine they gobble up a lot of your profit.
Yeah, well, you know, pigs themselves, it's really just, they make a mess, yeah, you know, but yeah. They don't eat the grapes.
Sorry, that's me and a fly.
Oh, okay. I thought you were signaling to me there.
Yeah, don't do that.
But I do something wrong. Yeah.
No, you're just fine. You're doing great, actually. Do you run into bears up here?
People have seen them. I haven't. People have seen bears and even mountain lions.
Mountain lions, sure. That would make sense because this is pretty isolated up here.
It's pretty remote even now. Yeah.
But that's what's fun about it. And again, the view is insane. Would we say you're kind of on sort of a ridge as we go through here?
It is a ridge top, yeah. And, you know, my vineyard, most of my vineyard has a northern exposure and the northern slope of this ridge, which gives a little bit different qualities as some of the vineyards on the southern side of it. Yeah, and the ridge continues on out to the west of here, and there are some big plantings that just went in a few years ago, about 10 miles west of here.
Sure. Now, are you selling your wines in restaurants or through a wine club, or how do you do it?
You know, mostly just the idea was direct-to-consumer website and that kind of thing, and you know, that's fine, but it's hard to ramp up to 400 cases doing that. So I am working with some brokers too who are doing some to wine clubs and so forth. I haven't started a wine club yet, or much of a restaurant portfolio yet. I'm still kind of in the brand building process, and you know, people who buy it obviously love it. I've gotten great reviews and so forth, but it's just it takes a lot of work, more work than I thought, and it takes more time. Yeah,
but I mean, in the end, to be able to buy wine 400 cases, you know, for a lot of our listeners, that's what they love, that's what they go for, is the small makers, because you know, it's got to be good.
Yeah, I mean, my first Petit Sirah vintage was only 80 cases. I mean, yeah, and people, when they hear that, they, like you say, they just love the idea. And but you're right, it's got to be good. There's no room to, as a producer, you know, there's really no room to screw up. When you're a grape grower, you know, if you have 1 year and it's a little bit off, you know, it's the winery's problem at that point. And I've had a whole new appreciation for winemaking doing this because I think the quality of the wines that people are making from my grapes has improved the last couple of years, just because I'm really doubling down, focused on quality. I mean, it has to be good. It certainly does for my label, because, you know, if an off year, I'm stuck with, you know, 400 cases that I can't sell. So, I have a renewed focus on quality.
Well, you're on the other side of it now, and that's a big deal, because it's a little bit like being a consumer versus a grower. I mean, you're really getting an idea of what people want.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I do push back when people say, you know, $50, $60, it's too expensive for Zinfandel, because when you see the low yields we get out here, I've had years as low as 1 ton per acre. I mean, last year was more normal, about 2 to 2.5, but yeah, it's there are reasons when, you know, for the cost, the wine cost being the way it is.
This year was an unusual growing year because you had such a wet winter, and I know a lot of wineries in the valley areas were harvesting later. How about up here?
You know, it was quite a bit later, and I think really? Yeah, I think most of Sonoma County was on the late side. Now, there may be other areas of the state that were early, but I'm pretty sure that Sonoma County was one of the later harvests we've had, yeah, and that was just because of the late start to the season, the colder spring. So when the vines come out late like that, they have a hard time really catching up. And then it cooled down again in September. I mean, things kind of dragged out into October this year.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm kind of curious, as a grower, especially for a long period of time that you've been doing it, and now a maker, is there kind of one big lesson you've learned from all this?
You mean as a from the grape growing perspective?
Well, as I said before, that you're on both sides of it now.
Oh.
I mean, yeah. Kind of like an influence that, you know, I said don't screw it up, but there's something more to it, obviously, than that.
You know, as a grower, one of the things, and it's just kind of habit, as the grapes pass for Asian, get turn color and get ripe, they're just great to snack on every day when you're out in the vineyard. You know, people initially will, they have seeds, you know, nobody wants to eat them, but really they're great tasting. The flavors that you get, you know, from those grapes in September before harvest are the exact same flavors that are going to show up in the wine afterwards. So having that, honing that skill without even thinking about it, about going by taste rather than, sugar, acid, and all that other stuff, just honing in on the taste before harvest to get the wine that you're after. That's probably the single thing I've learned most, one of the most important skills I've learned, I think.
That's really a good answer. So for you, it's not just measuring bricks, it's what you taste.
Right. Because you will often, and like I said before you got here, or before we started the interview, when you tasted the wine, and I said it's close to 16 alcohol, what I found is that those, before you get those flavors, the sugar is already, you know, 27, 28 before you even get that. So it produces, leads to challenges in the winemaking because nobody wants a, you know, 17 or, well, you couldn't even get there anyway because the fermentation would stick, you know. But you don't want a late harvest wine for a dinner wine.
So no.
you have to kind of work, that's part of the winemaking to work that out. It involves adding some water. This year, the petite was close enough that we were able to add some petite that was like 23, 24 to bring the sugar that's in down a little bit and do some co-fermentation at the same time. So,
did you ever consider doing a late harvest wine, or do you?
You know, like I said, I've been a grape grower for most of my career, and so if the winery had, you know, requested that, but no winery's ever wanted to do that with the fruit here. Mm. And myself, now, you know, I think it's not so much that it's a gimmick, it's just not a table wine, you know, and it's, I don't know if I could distinguish myself as well in that realm as I do in, say, in the table wines, I think.
Sure. Well, I was just kind of curious out of, you know, any kind of diversity, because there are people who do everything.
Yeah.
And then there are people who focus, and plenty in between. So I'm just kind of trying to see, you know, where else you might go. I'm guessing that all your acreage that you have available to you is planted.
Yeah, anything else I were to add would be more the difficult terrain, you know, and the county made it a lot more difficult years ago with the hillside ordinances that require engineering and that kind of thing. So it's not just a matter, you know, like when I started, of, you know, taking up the tractor and having at it. You really have to do some, and I guess that's for, you know, for good reason, for erosion control and that sort of thing. But it would be a lot more difficult in more ways than one to, you know, for another extra acre or two, it's, yeah, probably not worth it, yeah.
Well, in any hillside vineyard is always a challenge to harvest. Behind the house here, you were showing me the Lake Sonoma, and it's like, yeah, that's a good place to fall down.
Yeah, you know, and I insisted on doing this with a wheel tractor just because being the guy that drives it, you know, crawler tractors are really hard on the body. So yeah. I do it all with a wheel tractor, and some of it's really scary and some of it I have to back into and that kind of thing. But it's also a lot of fun. Yeah.
So otherwise it's a pretty easy job. Snakes, bears, occasional mountain lions, a tractor that would hurt you, but it's, and falling down, it's really pretty easy work. God, sorry, I couldn't resist. Now, you've been here for a good long time. I mean, it's going to be a silly question, but do you get that? Wake up every morning, look out the window and go, man, I don't believe I live here.
You know, there are days that I just go, wow, you know, because it's easy to get, you know, too used to it. And I try to get out and travel some because, you know, there are times of the year you kind of cabin fever sets in. But there are times, you know, it's just I do wake up and count my blessings, or when I'm out in the tractor because, you know, at sunrise, some of the best light of the day, as you would know, is in photography, and it's just amazing. And and that's what kind of keeps me doing it. It's like I would really miss this if I were to, you know, sell and move someplace. And it does get harder as you get older, but yeah, it's an amazing place to live and work.
Yeah, and you were talking about the light, which we are trying to blind you with here today, coming right into your eyes. But this might be a personal question, but do you have a plan for when you get to the point where you feel that you're not really going to be able to go out there and do the things you'd like to do?
You know, one of the luxuries of this occupation is that it's really only intense 3 months of the year. Well, you know, I would say from April to July, and then again a little bit in September with harvest. So it gives me a huge amount of time to go do other things, to travel, to you know, have hobbies and interests. So I'm not really, you know, that enables me to kind of do this longer. But I'd love to just keep, you know, I'd love to be out here in my 70s still doing it. Not having kids, I'm going to need, you know, help, more help than other people would, or maybe have a, you know, live-in help or something like that, you know. But, yeah, I'm trying to set up, I'm hoping that I can get to the point where I have more help and able to do this longer.
Sure.
You know, well into my old age.
Yeah. I think you probably will be. I think people like you who've done this for such a large part of your life, this becomes so ingrained.
Yeah, you know, and I think part of it is that I'm sure, you know, I know somebody right now who would do the tractor work for me if I wanted to. And I think part of it is I don't want to let go on any of this thing. And I don't think anybody's going to do it the way I want it done and so forth. So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. I don't know if you get a chance to do very many interviews. You mentioned that you'd done an interview recently, a podcast recently, but media otherwise, you do get to talk to a lot of people. This has become my favorite question. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Boy, I thought you were going to ask me the question I get asked all the time, which I was going to, I have all kinds of answers for that one.
Okay.
But the question I never get asked, you know, I think we already talked about the that would probably be the question. It would be how does what I do translate into what you get out of a glass, you know? And there's a lot that goes into it, and I think you have a sense of that. But really, you know, and you'd be surprised that even one person or two or three people on a vineyard this size can over the course of a couple of weeks before harvest, take it from what might have been a mediocre wine to a really great wine. And a lot of that is just sun, like we're seeing today, getting sun on the grapes, getting the air exposure, that if you're not here or if you're not aware of it, then it doesn't happen, and the wines are just, you know, so. So having that, the knowledge and ability to take the grapes that extra little bit. And timing is so important. You know, you can't just say, oh, I'll do it on the weekend or I'll do it next week.
No, they don't wait, do they?
Because, you know, yeah, you have to be aware of the weather always, and you have to do it, everything at just the right time. So, yeah, you know, it's tempting to think in September, I'm just going to coast to harvest now. I got 2 or 3 weeks, you know. But, no, that's when it's really, really important. Yeah, so I think that's kind of a meandered answer to your question. But I think the question would be, you know, what is it that a farmer does, that a grape grower does, that affects what people, you know, have in their glass?
No, that's a very good answer, because you have that unique perspective of doing both. But you didn't meander is a very good answer. I'm going to shut up here. Well, most importantly for our listeners who'd like to learn more about you, Jack, as well as about the vineyard and the wines you're making, what is your website?
Yeah, it's florencevineyard.com. So that's Florence Vineyard, all one word.
And people will be able to order your wines through the website?
They can, yeah.
Great. Well, I recommend they do. Jack.
Well, thanks.
Thank you very much for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Ray.
Learn more by visiting florencevineyard.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.